Hello and welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Every week I read from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. I have a must list today. They have an entire section that just got released that is about reality shows. They're calling it their Reality Rewind issue. And a couple reviews. So we won't even get through all the Reality Rewind issue articles, so we'll get to some of those next week. But let's start with the must list. The Residents, Andrew Scott in Vanya, and Bob Trevino likes it, top this week's must list. The Deal or No Deal Island finale and a new Jonas Brothers single round out our picks for the weekend. This is by a staff author. I was never that into the real world, but Road Rules was my jam. And as reality competition shows exploded with Survivor, Big Brother, and Amazing Race, I was glued to my screen. For a decade, I've hosted Friends every Wednesday for Wednesday and whichever of those three CBS shows are currently airing. Even if you're not a reality fan like me, but especially if you are, I encourage you to check out our Reality Rewind issue. Spearheaded by TV executive editor Samantha Highfill and brilliantly designed by art director Alex Sandoval, the issue breaks down the 25 best reality stars of the 2000s, looks back at the legacy of shows including The Swan, and game changers such as Big Brother 3's Daniel Reyes. Were your favorite Y2K reality stars included? Go find out. That was Patrick Gomez, editor-in-chief, and we will be finding out. So on the must list, the first item is The Residents. Uzo Aduba plays Cordelia Cupp, a brilliant and eccentric detective tasked with investigating the murder of a White House employee, played by Giancarlo Esposito, in Paul William Davies' new Netflix comedic whodunit from Shondaland. Everyone is a suspect. All 157 members of staff and guests at a state dinner for Australian dignitaries where the murder mystery occurs. As Cordelia investigates the upstairs, downstairs, and secret backstairs of Washington, D.C.'s most famous mansion, Susan Coletti Watson, Randall Park, Ken Marino, and Kylie Minogue, yes, Kylie Minogue, also star. Bob Trevino likes it. Writer-director Tracy Lehman's real-life friendship inspires this sweet film about two strangers, played by Barbie Ferreira and John Leguizamo, who meet by mistake when a young woman looks for her dad on the internet. A quiet, moving film about the need for human connection. Deal or No Deal Island. Host Joe Manganiello tells Entertainment Weekly the March 25th finale will be mind-blowing, riveting TV. And we believe him. We were on set in Panama during filming and concur with his assessment that people are going to be talking about it immediately after. Catch up on Peacock before the finale airs on NBC. Vanya. Andrew Scott of Fleabag and Ripley fame brings his one-man band take on Chekhov's Uncle Vanya to the cozy confines of the Lucille L'Hotel Theater in NYC for an intense tour de force performance. The actor skillfully plays nine different roles using props, tone, and mannerisms to differentiate the characters, with the compact setting making the action feel all the more intimate. And we have the Jonas Brothers' Love Me to Heaven. The Jonas Brothers definitely get better every time. After kicking off 2025 with collaborations featuring Marshmello and Rascal Flatts, the trio is returning to their pop roots. This addicting new single sets the tone for what the brothers say will be a year of music as they gear up to celebrate their 20th band anniversary with a variety of releases, including Joe Jonas's solo album, a live concert album, and soundtrack for their upcoming Christmas movie. That is our must list. The Residents, Andrew Scott in Vanya, and Bob Trevino Likes It top this week's must list. It was by a staff author. And there's not a review of The Residents, but I did come across an article from mid-December that we might not have covered, and it was the first look at The Residents. Uzo Aduba got advice from Olivia Pope herself for her Shondaland White House murder mystery, The Residents. This is an exclusive look at the Orange is the New Black stars Netflix screwball whodunit from Scandal alum Paul William Davies. And this is by Jessica Wang. So it's a little bit talking, it will probably mention that the show is coming in the future, but I thought it was a good background for something that just came out and they're saying we should be watching. And I did watch a couple episodes, it's pretty good. Paul William Davies was watching, of all things, archived C-SPAN testimony when inspiration struck. In it, the White House chief usher and other resident staff appeared before a Senate committee as part of an investigation into former President Bill Clinton circa the 1990s. It was really mundane stuff for the most part, Davies recalls to Entertainment Weekly. They were testifying about how various boxes might have been moved around on the third floor of the White House. But as they were describing all of these different rooms and staircases and passageways, I just had this epiphany. This house, it's like a clue board. Davies, a television writer and Shonda Rhimes collaborator who worked on Scandal and For the People, was in the early stages of creating what would become The Residents when it hit. Make this a murder mystery. Premiering March 20th, the Netflix screwball Whodunit, also executive produced by Rhimes, centers on a fictional murder in the White House. When a dead body is discovered during a state dinner with Australian dignitaries, eccentric detective Cordelia Cupp, played by Emmy winner Uzo Aduba, is called in to investigate. With 132 rooms and 157 suspects, Cordelia leaves no stone unturned, exploring the most famous mansion in Washington, D.C., and shining a light on its eclectic staff. Loosely based on Kate Anderson Brower's historical biography of the same name, it marks Davies' second White House-set Shondaland production post-Scandal, a drama about political fixer Olivia Pope, played by Kerry Washington. But don't expect it to be anything like Scandal. It's a very different part of the White House, says the showrunner and executive producer. We're never in the Oval Office or West Wing. It's just not part of the show. The tone and look and feel of it, it's very much its own thing, not just compared to Scandal, compared to anything set in the White House. It would be remiss of Entertainment Weekly, though, not to mention Olivia Pope when connecting with Aduba, a noted Scandal fan. Has she spoken with Washington at all to swap tales about the inner workings of Shondaland? We did chat about it, says Aduba. Actors understand what it is to come into the gig and do the work, and she was so generous. She talked about treating it like a sport, going into it, pacing yourself, and keeping your energy and being committed. She's a committed creative, which I love and respect. That's the environment that gets created on Shondaland sets as well, to be disciplined and pour yourself into it. Aduba was blown away when she received the script. It wasn't someone I played before, and it felt so thrilling, she says. I had to say yes just so I could find out who did it. A worthy addition to the fictional detective canon, Cordelia is a sharp observer. She's off-centered in the best way. An avid birder, too, often disappearing behind the lens of her binoculars. She looks at cases from that point of view, taking in everything from a bird's eye, observes Aduba, who even took up birding for the role. It's very relaxing. It's an activity that requires patience. You're listening to everything and seeing things that you wouldn't have given any attention to. Aduba calls Cordelia so entirely herself, adding, she doesn't get intimidated by the room. That's a pretty big room to step into, the White House. Despite being in that space, she knows her stuff and who she is in the world. The character, notes Davies, just sort of created herself. I didn't set out to create a classic detective, he says. When I started thinking about how the murder mystery would work, I thought the detective would be an important but almost peripheral character, that we'd really tell this whole story through the White House staff. But the more I thought about Cordelia and started to write Cordelia, the more Cordelia became Cordelia. The killer cast also includes Susan Coletti Watson, Al Franken, Jason Lee, Randall Park, and Giancarlo Esposito, the latter taking over the role of Chief Usher A.B. Winter from the late André Breuer. Breuer filmed 4 episodes before the dual Hollywood strikes paused production in 2023 and died in December of that year from lung cancer. I told him when we first met that I used to watch Homicide: Life on the Street at an extremely inappropriate age, recalls Aduba of the loving and remarkable star. He had such a depth of range and brought warmth, professionalism, and knowledge to the set every day. Davies also remembers Brar's warmth and intelligence. The first time he came to the studio, we sat down for a few hours and talked about his character, he recalls. I'd been working on this for 3 years at that point, had thought this all through at a molecular level, and within 5 minutes he had me confronting things I'd never really thought about, or only inadequately. It wasn't a gotcha spirit. He really wanted to understand who this person was, what I wanted him to be. He was so unbelievably smart and thoughtful. Though his scenes were reshot, Brower's spirit lives on through the show, and to that point, Davies promises a satisfying one. There are a lot of suspects and clues, and the careful viewer will be rewarded by paying attention to these things, he says, of what unfolds. As you get deeper into the episodes, you start to learn more about folks that you might have only thought were minor figures at the start. It just gets richer and more fun. Your jaws will be on the ground, adds Aduba. It's not what you expect. That's Uzo Aduba got advice from Olivia Pope herself for her Shondaland White House murder mystery, The Residence, and it was by Jessica Wang. From the TV section, we have this review, Good American Family, a suspenseful spin on the Natalia Grace saga. Hulu's limited series stars Ellen Pompeo and Mark Duplass as Christine and Michael Barnett. This is by Kristen Baldwin. Every episode of Good American Family, Hulu's new true life drama based on the story of Ukrainian adoptee turned tabloid sensation Natalia Grace, begins with a robust disclaimer. This series portrays certain allegations by the individuals involved in this story, including in-court proceedings and as publicly reported, it reads in part. It reflects and dramatizes multiple conflicting points of view and does not intend to suggest that any particular allegation is the whole truth. Such lawyer-mandated equivocation could be the death knell for quality storytelling, but creator Katie Robbins from Sunny synthesizes the myriad perspectives into a solid and engaging dramatization of this headline-grabbing saga. While Good American Family is unlikely to offer anything new for the millions of viewers who've already watched the Investigation Discovery docuseries, The Curious Case of Natalia Grace, The uninitiated will find it to be an effective introduction to this very sad, sordid, and surreal series of events. In 2010, Indiana couple Christine, played by Ellen Pompeo, and Michael Barnett, played by Mark Duplass, receive a call that a little girl named Natalia Grace, played by Imogen Faith Reed, who was born in Ukraine with a rare form of dwarfism, needs immediate placement with a family or she'll be sent to a group home. Christine, who became an advocate for children with disabilities after working with her autistic son Jacob, played by A.S. Dahlman, urges Michael to agree to Natalia's adoption, despite their ongoing marital troubles. Soon after bringing Natalia home, however, she begins to act out aggressively, and Christine starts to suspect that the little girl is significantly older than she claims to be. As Natalia's behavior becomes more violent, and the Barnett's research into her past raises more disturbing questions, Christine and Michael take extraordinary measures to remove Natalia from their lives. Good American Family spends the first four episodes presenting Natalia's experience from Christine and Michael's point of view. Just as the heroes and villain are thrown into sharp relief, however, the series switches to Natalia's perspective, and a new but equally horrifying story emerges. The real Natalia Grace has always maintained that she was born in 2003, not in 1989, as the Barnetts later alleged, and that she was still a child when Michael and Christine left her to live alone in a rented apartment in 2013. As the second half of the series unfolds, Natalia is shown struggling to survive on her own until a neighbor, Cynthia Manns, played by Christina Hendricks, takes her in. Meanwhile, after a lengthy investigation, Detective Brandon Drysdale, played by Dulé Hill, arrests Christine and Michael on multiple counts of neglect of a dependent. This clever, focus-shifting structure allows showrunners Robbins and Sarah Sutherland to dramatize the most lurid horror movie aspects of the story without appearing to endorse one version over another. Both sides of the nightmare get full play. Natalia as the evil interloper, standing at the foot of her parents' bed with a knife and luring her brother into oncoming traffic. Christine as the image-obsessed, physically abusive monster mom preying on her most vulnerable charge. The resulting cognitive dissonance fosters a sense of anxiety that mirrors the paranoia Christine and Natalia each feel. Why does nobody believe me? Starring in her first leading role as Natalia, Reed captures the fragility and overbearing moodiness of a school-aged child, as well as the composed detachment of a potential sociopath. Pompeo has never been a performer who radiates much warmth, but her aloof, annoyed mien gels nicely with the dogged child advocate and controlling wife version of Christine Barnett we meet in the early episodes. And the actress generates impressive menace as Natalia's version of Christine in the latter half of the season. By any account, the story of Natalia Grace and the Barnett family is dark, strange, and sometimes absurd. Good American Family doesn't always maintain a consistent tone, especially with its depiction of Michael Barnett. Depressed and cowed by his wife, Michael comes across as naive to the point of foolishness. And there are moments when his haplessness is played for laughs. Did we really need to see the guy stress vomit donuts into a conference room table at his lawyer's office? Probably not. But Duplass resists turning his character into a joke, fusing Michael's desperate optimism with internalized panic and helplessness. As with so many series adapted from true life events, Family can't deliver a substantive explanation for why Christine or Natalia would have done the terrible things they each accuse the other of doing. Christine, who wrote a popular memoir in 2013 about dealing with Jacob's autism, is depicted as being more focused on her burgeoning fame than what's best for her family. And an early episode shows the Barnetts taking Natalia to a child therapist, played by Tracy Toms, who suggests that their daughter suffers from reactive attachment disorder, which can cause behavior issues in children. Of course, the only people who know what really happened are the ones who lived it, and none of the real people depicted here were involved in the series. Michael Barnett sold the rights to his story to the production, but also did not participate in the making of the show. The truth, or as much of it as we'll ever know, comes into a bit more focus in the final two episodes of Good American Family. Still, a full understanding of what happened with Natalia Grace and the Barnett family remains out of reach. In all its configurations, Natalia's story plays on some of our most primal fears: annihilation, abandonment, shame, which may be why it continues to hold such a fascination for the public. I went into Good American Family not knowing much about Natalia Grace, and I came out knowing more, but not nearly enough. Questions were Googled, rabbit holes were entered, episodes of the investigation documentary series were streamed. So be forewarned, Natalia Grace newbies. Good American Family is a gateway drug, and we are hardwired to get hooked. The first two episodes of Good American Family premiered Wednesday, April 19th on Hulu. That was a review of Good American Family, a suspenseful spin on the Natalia Grace saga. It was by Kristen Baldwin, and she's giving the series a grade of B. In the movie section, we also have a review. Snow White, Disney's best live-action remake, is the fairest of them all, thanks to Rachel Zegler. Not since Kenneth Branagh's Cinderella has a Disney reimagining worked so well. A winning score and charming romantic leads make up for the film's few shortcomings. This is by Patrick Gomez. Hollywood can't seem to get enough of remakes and reboots. Most of them empty cash plays with nothing to add to the original aside from maybe updated visual effects. Disney's live-action Snow White is not that. The bones of Walt Disney's first big swing into feature-length animation, a young princess ordered killed by her evil stepmother, is spared and finds friends in the dwarves and woodland creatures of the forest, takes a bite of a poison apple, is saved by a kiss, remain intact in director Mark Webb's, he's known for 500 Days of Summer and The Amazing Spider-Man, reimagining of 1937's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. But screenwriter Erica Cressida Wilson, known for Secretary and The Girl on the Train, and songwriters Benj Pasek and Justin Paul from Dear Evan Hansen and The Greatest Showman, more than literally take these previously two-dimensional characters and flesh them out in a fully formed 3D world. Deserving equal credit for the successes of this dreamy fairy tale is star Rachel Zegler. When news of her casting broke, much of the unfortunate corners of social media had a lot to say about the fact that her skin was not white as snow. She is, apparently, much to the surprise of some West Side Story executives, Latina, after all. And more recent headlines about the film predominantly focused on real-life drama involving her evil queen, Gal Gadot. But from the moment Zegler appears on screen, after a prologue that establishes younger Snow White's loving relationship with her parents, it's clear she was born to play a Disney princess. As Snow White, the superstar in the making exudes a quiet earnestness, but with passion and purpose always flickering behind those big almond eyes. Wilson provides Zegler's princess with agency and purpose beyond dreaming that someday my prince will come. In fact, that song and its prince are nowhere to be found. Instead, with Waiting on a Wish, which had hashtag theater talk a flurry when it was released as the lead single of the film's soundtrack, Zegler's airy yet powerful vocals profess the character's desire to step up and become the girl I'm meant to be, someone who could finally start speaking with a fearless heart, someone who just might be brave, someone no one needs to save. Even when it comes time to clean the dwarves' cottage, this Snow White is a commander-in-chief, teaching not animals, but the dwarves themselves how to tidy up their own home and whistle while you work, just one of three Frank Churchill and Larry Morey songs that were updated for the new film with, frankly, surprising success. And this Snow White isn't resigned to life in exile. She aims to venture south and investigate rumors her father is still alive and return to her kingdom, where they can lead with compassion that's been missing since her mother's death and father's disappearance. There's no denying this is solidly Snow White's movie. Perhaps that's why Disney dropped And the Seven Dwarves this time around. Aiding the princess is a band of rebels led by the dashing Jonathan, played by Tony winner Andrew Burnup. From his hair to his wardrobe to the white horse he rides at one point, Burnup's Jonathan is basically in Flynn Rider cosplay, giving us the closest we've gotten to live-action Tangled so far. Like in the 1939 film, Snow White meets her potential true love at the castle. But this time, they actually establish a camaraderie as partners in literal crime rather than just jumping right to a kiss at the end of the film. While he's not a prince, Burnup is truly charming, particularly in his beautifully shot duet with Zegler, A Hand Meets a Hand. Burnup and Zegler's chemistry is innocent but palpable. Their relationship feels real, and their eventual kiss earned. It's when Snow White deviates from that grounded reality that the film is less successful. I'll leave it to others to continue the debate about whether Disney should have cast little people as the dwarves. As it stands, Martin Kleba voices Grumpy, and George Appleby plays a memorable member of Jonathan's troupe. But the choice to use CGI is jarring, distracting from the dwarves' otherwise delightful introduction in the film. Until their arrival, Snow White feels like a fairy tale set in a very real world, albeit one with a magic mirror. A forced perspective option may have kept the vibe alive or, at the very least, allowed the fun cast of dwarves, including the voice of Titus Burgess as Bashful and George Salazar as Happy, to feel individual. Aside from the motion capture puppeteers sneezing or furrowing a brow in correspondence to their character's name, six of these dwarves seem interchangeable, and all sound a little like Josh Gad for some reason. Dopey, voiced, yes, by Andrew Barth Feldman, is the one exception, due to the character's more youthful appearance, though he may sound the most gaddy. And while Pasek and Paul's songs deserve all the awards buzz they're sure to generate, despite sounding all a little familiar to fans of their work, an understandable pitfall of many legendary contributors to the Great American Songbook, Kander and Ebb, Sondheim, Miranda, they pack less of a punch when sung by Gadot. The former Wonder Woman makes the most of her limited character and chews the scenery, but sounds almost metallic on the Evil Queen's big song and reprise, a stark contrast to Zegler's crystal-clear vocals. Given the source material, it's expected that Zegler ends the film reprising the uplifting opening song Good Things Grow, my favorite, but it is pleasantly surprising that the Snow White team resisted the urge to make her leading lady a commander-in-chief again, rallying troops into some epic Act III battle against the Queen, as one has come to expect from these reimaginings. That balance of giving the audience the story they know so well, but with just the right amount of newness and unpredictability, is the true magic of Webb's Snow White. It makes me all the more hopeful for Lilo and Stitch. That's our Snow White review. Disney's best live-action remake is the fairest of them all, thanks to Rachel Zegler. It was by Patrick Gomez, and he's giving the movie a rating of B+. That gets us through the newest reviews, TV and movies, and it's a good time to take a break to say that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly, and I'm reading from their website, EW.com. We lost somebody just recently. George Foreman, championship boxer and grill mogul, dies at 76. The two-time heavyweight champ and Olympic gold medalist became the famous face of the George Foreman grill and even starred in his own ABC sitcom, George. This is by Wesley Stenzel. George Foreman, the boxing great who went on to become a grill entrepreneur and occasional TV star, has died. He was 76. Foreman's official Instagram account announced the news on Friday night. "Our hearts are broken. With profound sorrow, we announce the passing of our beloved George Edward Foreman Sr., who peacefully departed on March 21, 2025, surrounded by loved ones," the statement read. "A devout preacher, a devoted husband, a loving father, and a proud grand and great-grandfather, he lived a life marked by unwavering faith, humility, and purpose." A two-time world heavyweight champion and an Olympic gold medalist, Foreman is widely considered one of the greatest boxers of all time, yet his achievements in the ring seldom overshadowed his achievements as a businessman or his convictions as a born-again Christian. He also worked as a ringside commentator for HBO for 12 years and appeared on numerous television series, including the short-lived ABC sitcom George, the reality travel series Better Late Than Never, and the music competition show The Masked Singer. The post on Foreman's account went on to describe the late boxer as a humanitarian, an Olympian, and two-time heavyweight champion of the world, who was deeply respected, a force for good, a man of discipline, conviction, and a protector of his legacy, fighting tirelessly to preserve his good name for his family. The post concluded, "We are grateful for the outpouring of love and prayers and kindly ask for privacy as we honor the extraordinary life of a man we were blessed to call our own." Cheryl Lee Ralph, who starred on George with the boxer in 1993, paid tribute to him on Instagram. "My heart is with the Foreman family today. George had a smile as wide as his spirit and a heart full of kindness," she wrote. "I'll never forget how eager he was to learn, grow, and give his all." Of the images she included with the post, she wrote, "These photos take me back to 1993, when we filmed his very first sitcom, George. From the ring to the screen, he showed up with joy, humility, and heart. Rest well, my friend." Born in 1949 in Marshall, Texas, Foreman began his boxing career as an amateur in 1967, rising through the ranks and eventually defeating the Soviet Union boxer Jonas Sepulis in just 2 rounds to win the gold medal for heavyweight boxing at the 1968 Mexico City Olympics. Foreman went pro in 1969, amassing a 37-0 record over the next 4 years. He faced off against undefeated reigning champion Joe Frazier in 1973 for his first shot at the heavyweight championship, ultimately emerging victorious over Frazier in his first defeat in January 1973. Foreman successfully defended his title against Jose Roman and Ken Norton, then lost it in his only fight against Muhammad Ali, his first professional loss, at the iconic Rumble in the Jungle face-off in 1974. Following a year-long hiatus, Foreman won five more fights in 1976 and early 1977 before being defeated by Jimmy Young, resulting in a near-death experience that prompted his unofficial retirement and his conversion to Christianity. He joined the Church of the Lord Jesus Christ, a Holiness Pentecostal in Houston, eventually becoming its pastor in 1980 and opening a youth center. Foreman returned to the ring in 1987, launching a 24-fight winning streak that lasted 3 years before his third-ever loss to Evander Holyfield in 1991 in a championship challenge. 3 years later, he successfully defeated Michael Moore to regain heavyweight championship status, becoming the oldest fighter to ever hold a world championship at age 45. Foreman continued boxing until 1997, when he was defeated by Shannon Briggs, prompting his retirement with an overall pro record of 76-5. He then worked as a ringside analyst for HBO for more than a decade. During his comeback, Foreman began promoting Salton Incorporated's Portable Grill in 1994. The company ultimately paid the boxer over $137 million for the rights to use his name on the product. Foreman is survived by his wife, his five sons, all named George Foreman, and his six daughters. That is George Foreman, championship boxer and grill mogul, dies at 76. And it was by Wesley Stenzel. So let's take a dip into this reality rewind issue that we were hearing about earlier. Here are 10 reality shows from the 2000s we still can't believe existed. The 2000s were such a bonanza for bad reality TV ideas, it was hard to narrow this list down to just 10. This is by Kristen Baldwin and Dalton Ross. Today, reality TV is so ubiquitous, it's easy to forget how much people, and by people, I mean critics, hated the genre, which exploded in popularity after the premiere of Survivor in 2000. To be fair to those critics, however, many of the shows TV networks threw on the air in hopes of capitalizing on the reality trend were mind-boggling dumb. The first decade of the 2000s was such a bonanza for bad reality TV ideas, it was hard to narrow this list down to just 10. Nevertheless, we persisted. Critics excoriated the programs highlighted below as amateurish and moronic, grotesque and creepy, and too panderingly stupid to get seriously upset about. Readers, they weren't wrong. Please enjoy this nostalgic look back at some of reality TV's lowest moments. Our number one of 10, The Moment of Truth. It was on Fox in 2008. Honestly, this entire list could all be Fox shows if we wanted, and we could have gone 20 deep, easy. Perhaps the most diabolical game show of all time, The Moment of Truth, asked its competitors a series of insanely personal questions while strapped to a polygraph and then made them answer those questions in front of a live studio audience, often including their spouses, ex-lovers, family members, and co-workers. As long as they told the truth, damn the consequences for what they were about to admit to their loved ones and millions of viewers, they would keep winning money up to $500,000. The show's three-season run included one infamous episode which featured an opening disclaimer by host Mark L. Wahlberg in which he voiced, quite honestly, if I had my vote, it would not air. That was because 26-year-old salon manager Lauren Cleary admitted in front of her police officer husband sitting a few feet away that she had cheated on him, took her wedding ring off in public, faked being asleep to avoid having sex, and wished she had married her ex-boyfriend instead. Cleary was finally eliminated, however, after being caught lying on the question of whether she felt she was a good person. She answered yes. Next, it's Chains of Love, that aired on UPN in 2001. A full decade before quote-unquote cuffing season entered our national lexicon, UPN offered viewers a literal version with this asinine dating show. In each episode, one single man or woman, dubbed the picker, was shackled to four eligible contestants of the opposite sex. Over the course of a four-day period, the group spent every waking and sleeping hour together, going out to dinner, grocery shopping, bowling, etc., all while chained together. One by one, the picker dumped contestants they weren't clicking with the help from the locksmith, one of the dumbest, most delightful reality TV sidekicks of all time. Eventually, only one lucky, depending on how you want to define that word, single was left standing, and if the picker was smitten, the two shared a cash prize. As one UPN exec told Entertainment Weekly at the time, "The chains are metaphors for the bonds of human affection. People are going to be surprised by how revealing it is." Oh, did he say revealing? We're pretty sure he meant redonkulous. Man vs. Beast was on Fox from 2003 to 2004. If you wanted to watch a world-class sprinter race against a giraffe in the early 2000s, then the Fox network was definitely the place to be. And if that sprinter happened to beat the giraffe, you better damn be sure he was going up against a zebra next. These interspecies shenanigans were all part of the channel's two Man vs. Beast specials, which also pitted Takeru Kobayashi in a hot dog eating contest against a Kodiak bear, had 44 little people face off against an elephant in a race to pull a DC-10 airplane, and made an all-American gymnast take on an orangutan named Bam Bam in a dead hang competition that featured such edge-of-your-seat play-by-play commentary as, "I think the important thing to notice right now is Bam Bam does have a little bit of difficulty, and that he's losing his shorts." Regardless of the individual outcome of each competition, I think it is fair to say that the overall loser in this entire reality TV experiment was both man and mankind in general. Kid Nation aired on CBS in 2007. Reality TV, much like the internet, is where nuance goes to die. Producers of this controversial series, which placed 40 kids aged 8 to 15 on an isolated ranch in New Mexico and tasked them with building a functional society, insisted their goal was to deliver an authentic social experiment. As creator Tom Foreman told the Los Angeles Times, the hope was for kids to succeed where adults have failed. But all it took was a 4-minute teaser featuring kids weeping, arguing, and struggling with daily chores for critics to label the show the worst example of child exploitation since the textile mills in Dickinson, London. The truth was somewhere in the middle. No, Kid Nation was never officially charged with violating child labor laws, but one kid did accidentally drink bleach and another sustained a minor burn while cooking. Yes, the promos promised no adults, but no, the kids weren't alone. As former contestant Taylor DuPriest told Entertainment Weekly in 2008, "I was surprised that everybody ended up making so much controversy that we were by ourselves, because that's not true. There were more camera crew and producers than there were kids. At least one truth cannot be disputed. This reality show should have never made it past the pitch meeting. Manhunt was on UPN in 2001. The cheesy premise of this 2001 UPM entry, allegedly filmed in Hawaii, was that a group of, and I am quoting here, soft-bellied suburbanites had to cross an island in 6 days while being stalked by paintball gun-toting fake bounty hunters who clearly set their weapons to humiliate. One of those bounty hunters was none other than John Cena, going here by the name of Big Tim for some reason, who would celebrate a kill by shaving his victim's head while spewing some very amateur-level smack talk. On one hand, there was nothing so egregiously terrible about Manhunt to set it apart from scores of similar failed early-era reality competition shows. Well, that's not necessarily true. It was pretty damn bad, but making things even worse was when it was uncovered that certain scenes were shot later back in Los Angeles. A producer on the show, Bob Jaffe, accused the studio of reshooting interviews and altering other scenes, and said he was fired after refusing to manipulate results. For their part, the studio and network issued a joint statement admitting to some reshoots, but insisting that UPN and Paramount have not supported and would not support persons or practices designed to manipulate the outcome of the show. The statement did not, however, explain why they aired the damn thing in the first place. Are You Hot? Aired on ABC in 2003. The worst part about Are You Hot?, the search for America's sexiest people, wasn't its egregiously shallow concept, which executive producer Mike Fleiss explained thusly. You just see good-looking people either validated as gorgeous or cut to shreds as posers. It wasn't Judge Lorenzo Lamas and his laser pointer, which he'd use to point out contestants' physical flaws, or the sleazy comments he made to female hot hopefuls. I got a burrito cooking down south, and it's almost ready. It wasn't the way host J.D. Roberto would send eliminated contestants home by announcing, "I'm very sorry, you are not hot enough to continue." No! The worst part about Are You Hot is that this objectively stupid idea wasn't even original. The series was a ripoff of a regular Howard Stern segment called The Evaluators. Stern later settled a lawsuit against ABC and producers. Though the premiere drew more than 10 million viewers, ABC ultimately killed Are You Hot after one season, admitting that the show was in bad taste. Number 7 of 10 is Boy Meets Boy on Bravo in 2003. On its surface, Boy Meets Boy seemed like a simple bachelor-type dating show for gay men, as one, James Getzloff eliminated eligible suitors along the way to finding his true love. But halfway through Bravo's thoroughly regrettable 2003 series, producers clued Getzloff into their super problematic twist. Half the men were actually straight and merely posing as gay in the hopes of winning a cash prize. If Getzloff's gaydar was strong enough and the man he ultimately chose was homosexual, they would win a romantic vacation together and share in a cash prize. But if he picked a heterosexual, the man merely posing as gay would take home the entire loot. Perhaps even more inexplicable than this show even making it to air is the fact that another network then essentially did a variation on the same thing. Yes, 1 year later, the Fox network, who else, aired Playing It Straight, in which a woman tried to find her true love among a group of half-straight and half-gay men, eliminating the ones she thought were gay along the way. Thankfully, Playing It Straight was pulled from the schedule after only 3 episodes, but not before it spawned multiple international editions, because of course it did. Number 8 is Mr. Personality, which was on Fox in 2003. After The Bachelor premiered in 2002 and became an instant hit for ABC, other networks raced to create their own addictive dating show. Under the bold and twisted guidance of chief reality exec Mike Darnell, Fox debuted Mr. Personality, aka The Bachelorette. But all the guys have to wear creepy masks. For 26-year-old stockbroker Haley Arp, Love is Blind meant dating 20 eligible men without ever being able to see their faces until she sent them home. Adding to the absurdity was the network's choice of host, Monica Lewinsky, whose mere existence was still considered scandalous back in 2003. Fox's other entries into the dating genre, including More to Love, aka Plus Size Bachelor, and The Littlest Groom, aka Little Person Bachelor, were bonkers in their own way, but you really haven't seen weird until you've watched a bikini-clad woman share a hot tub with 5 guys in full latex head coverings. And no, those masks were not comfortable. According to Entertainment Weekly's interview with a contestant in 2003, some men wore maxi pads under their masks to absorb the sweat. Number 9 was on Fox in 2005. It's Who's Your Daddy? There's no greater bond than that between parent and child. Those were the first words uttered on this Fox 2005 series that then proceeded to immediately exploit those bonds in what could arguably be described as the network's true moral nadir. The show featured 8 men, each trying to convince adopted TJ Myers that they were her true biological father, naturally with cash on the line. After interviewing each of the potential daddies, if Myers correctly identified the man who gave her up, she won $100,000. If she was wrong, the phony dad received the prize instead. While we will award points for the on-point reunion line at the end of Sweetheart, I'm Home, we will deduct points for pretty much everything else. Who's Your Daddy was canceled after a single episode, with the remaining 5 installments being burned off on the Fox Reality Channel during, you guessed it, Father's Day. And our number 10 entry, Extreme Makeover, aired on ABC in 2002. Today, this franchise is largely remembered as a staple of feel-good home renovation TV. But Extreme Makeover started as a feel-gross makeover series featuring everyday folks desperate to change their looks through plastic surgery, wardrobe upgrades, diet plans, and other superficial improvements. In season 1, 10 million viewers watched each week as contestants met with a phalanx of doctors, underwent plastic surgery, and suffered through painful recoveries, and ultimately revealed the results to friends and family as a living after photo. ABC launched the Extreme Makeover Home Edition spinoff in 2004. Hoping to capitalize on Extreme's success, Fox launched their own cosmetic surgery-themed series called The Swan, which upped the ugly duckling ante by adding a beauty pageant element to the proceedings. By the time E! Unleashed Bridalplasty, 12 brides-to-be compete for a medical makeover and a dream wedding in 2010, America's madness for makeovers had faded and the show was canceled after 1 season. Those are the 10 reality shows from the 2000s we still can't believe existed, and it was by Kristen Baldwin and Dalton Ross. That just begins to scratch the surface of the reality rewind issue. It was pretty extraordinary, though. We'll come back next week with a few other articles from that issue. I missed many of those shows in the 2000s, and they are pretty shocking to me so far. While I'm here, I'll mention something that I don't bring up very often, but there is a new app for Sun Sounds of Arizona. You can get the app from wherever you download an Android or Apple app for your phone, and it's really handy. It has all the shows. You can listen live to any of the shows being broadcast from Tempe, Tucson, or Flagstaff. You can also listen to past episodes, and they're all categorized just like they are on the website: business, shopping, entertainment, science, things like that. And then you can choose from some of the more recent shows that have been broadcast in case you missed a show and want to listen to it, or if you want to re-listen to a show because you want to catch a detail or because you liked it so much. That is the Sun Sounds app, and it's available through download wherever you get your Android or Apple apps now. This brings us to the end of Entertainment Weekly for this week. Thank you all for listening. I've been reading from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com, and you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury, and until next time, goodbye.